come. And welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're going to take a look at this presidential race. There's lots of news in it. The confrontation that many black activists had with two of the presidential candidates, the issues surrounding the Democratic candidates and whether or not they can inspire the people who put Barack Obama in office, the questions facing the Republican Party with Donald Trump now out ahead and what that means, if anything. We are here with Nadi Prupas, who is a progressive journalist and staff writer for Common Dreams. Nadi, welcome. Good to have you with us for the first time.
Thank you very much.
Lenny McAllister, Republican strategist, former congressional candidate, host of Night Talk. Get to the point on Pittsburgh Cable News and get right with Lenny McAllister on News Radio 1020, KDKA in Pittsburgh. Lenny, always good to have you back with us.
Mark, always enjoy being on with you.
And Tom Schaller, professor of political science at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He writes a political column for the Baltimore Sun, author of Stronghold, How Republicans Captured Congress But Surrendered the White House. And we're always looking forward to his next book. Welcome to the program once again, Tom. And good to have you all with us at 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can also tweet us at Mark Steiner, but do call in if you can, 410-319-8888. Let me just begin on the Republican side of the fence here. As everybody has been watching the kind of rise of Donald Trump in the polls and his latest statements about John McCain not being a war hero because he was in a prisoner of war, and why he's taken this 24% lead in the polls, at least the most recent polls that came out by ABC News, where they said Trump led by 24%, Scott Walker with 16%, and Jeb Bush at 12%. Early in the race, it might mean nothing, Lenny McAllister, but it sure has caught on with many kind of conservative activists.
Yeah, but Herman Cain was at the top of the polls this time 4 years ago, talking about an electrified fence and 999 and you Becky Sam. And he was at the top of the polls. So, I mean, we have to keep this in context. I mean, Michelle Bachmann at one point in time won a straw poll and literally knocked out Tim Pawlenty from the race. Tim Pawlenty was the front runner until Michelle Bachmann won the Iowa straw poll, and then Tim Pawlenty folded his tent literally 6 hours after the straw, about 12 hours after the straw poll was over, literally that Sunday morning. He's suspending his campaign. So, you know, it's very early in the process. I mean, John Kasich is going to jump into the race. He's a term governor in a very key swing state for Republicans, somebody that got 25% of the African-American vote with his last election. This is somebody that should be taken seriously, but won't be as long as Trump's making bombastic statements in July. But the real candidates that have been planning this out for years, not just weeks or months, they're going to have a little bit of persistence and allow the shiny new car to get a traffic ticket, hit a pothole, run out of gas.
And Tom Schaller, before you turn to Nadi, I mean, you've been covering this kind of politics for years and years. And I think we're often kind of media-sized, for want of a better term, candidates like Trump and put them in places they probably don't belong in the first place.
Well, I mean, he's a fascinating story. I mean, if you had told me that in a field this big where you have everybody, you know, including George Pataki, people that probably self-identified Republicans can't name in a poll or self-identify, right? You would think that Trump, you know, would sort of get washed out because there's a big menu, right? There's a lot of choice. Every person from whatever element or faction of the Republican Party, whether they're in the homeschool wing or the NRA wing or the fiscal austerity wing, you know, and fill in the blank for the next, you know, 14 different slivers and slices of the Republican and conservative coalition, you would think there'd just be no room for him. But then as I started to think about his numbers, it's like there are so many candidates that in a weird way, all of those factions are spread out across so many different candidates that Trump is probably benefiting from the fact that it's not 2012. Where there's a 3 or 4 candidate race. And by the way, 15-20% when you're dividing 100% by whatever it is, 14-15 candidates, I can't keep track of the number anymore of who's officially declared. 15% is a lot, right? You know, 15% is a lot.
That is a lot.
And that's enough to start, you know, obviously get invited to debate, but also to start winning delegates in primary states. Now, I think Trump will face. But it's a serious problem in the near term for the Republican Party, what he's doing.
And Nadi, how do you view it from the progressive side of the fence?
From a progressive side, it's hard to take Trump seriously to begin with. But he, you know, the fact that he's rising in the polls is, as early as it is, it's hard, even though it's hard to tell at first, it is a worrying thought to have that he has so many supporters. So we're definitely we're keeping an eye on it while at the same time sort of trying to view his comments from the lens of a candidate who focuses more on being bombastic and saying sort of controversial things because it gets him more media time rather than someone with real presidential aspirations.
Now, and I wonder in some ways, though, that people like Trump, because there are so many people in this country who are so disenchanted with the political process, the system as it works with both Democrats and Republicans, if that's the kind of candidate that just ordinarily attracts people who are angry, whether it's from the right, the left, or the middle, people are just fed up. And he's the fed up vote at the moment that will probably dissipate mm-hmm. once he continues to say absurd things.
It's hard to say because I think you're right. I think a lot of the initial attraction is the fact that he's being very outlandish and he's saying things that probably a lot of people who support some of those similar policies agree with. But I think that once it becomes clear that maybe he has a lot of rhetoric but maybe not a lot of ideas, and I think that that's been clear in the past, but now that the presidential race is really starting to pick up speed and we're getting to the year of the election, I think that people will become less enamored with such a cartoonish candidate. So I agree with you. I think that the people are right now, they're latching on to some of his more outlandish statements because they're fed up and they like that he's different in that way, but I don't think that it can possibly last.
And I'll say something here that I'm sure, Lenny, it's not for you to take umbrage at, but just a question. And I'm wondering, let me start with Tom and go right to Lenny. I mean, whether the kind of rhetoric that Trump puts out there really does appeal to a piece of the electorate, the Republican electorate especially.
Yeah, that's problematic. I mean, it ends up being an interesting little conundrum for the Republican Party is, you know, they acknowledge that this is part of our base, unfortunately, and now here it is metastasizing into another key race because we haven't dealt with this effectively. Now, of course, he's not talking about black people in this instance, or he's not talking about women, you know, who get raped, cannot possibly get pregnant. And this time, it's about Mexicans and basically talking about the largest minority group in the United States and throwing them in all to one bag under one label and just kind of bashing them about. So this is something that the conservative base has known for years, and unfortunately, this is something that should have been dealt with, Mark, with the Tea Party movement. The Tea Party movement at its core was a great movement about smaller government, bigger people. The basic principles were great. It got hijacked by a lot of fringe groups that attached themselves to it for all the wrong reasons. You go from smaller government to Obama signs and you know, Zulu outfits. You go from, you know, I don't want Obamacare for these legitimate reasons to, you know, President Obama is a watermelon-eating antichrist. They allowed the fringes to take over the message, and that is now going on for 5 years. If you don't get rid of them within 5 months, how in the world are you going to reverse 5 years of this type of damage coming up into 2016, and that's just enough momentum, just enough of a bump to allow somebody like a Donald Trump with a couple of comments that people are going to feel because they're angry too, to allow them to rise to the polls. Now, of course, like I said, the establishment, if you're not going to deal with it five weeks in 2010, you can't overreact in 2015. You got to let him basically blow himself up, proverbially speaking, and then be prepared to pick up the pieces and move forward and hope that it happens in July 2015, not July 2016.
Mm-hmm. Tom?
Yeah, I agree with almost all of that. I think the thing about the anger is that obviously the anger is ultimately directed at Obama or liberals or the politically correct police or whatever. But in the near term, because it's a Republican primary, that anger is channeled momentarily and very heartfeltly toward Republicans who conservatives feel are not articulating those critiques because they're afraid of offending somebody or being labeled as politically incorrect. So in the mind of conservatives who are energized or animated by Trump's refreshing honesty or Ben Carson's honesty about, you know, prison sexuality, you think, why? How is it these people are rising in the polls over comments about, you know, coyotes raping women, which, by the way, is a nasty little human tragedy, and it's a good way of sort of turning liberal ideology back on the liberals? Or how is Ben Carson being taken seriously when he says these stupid things about, you know, people making sexuality a choice because they have gay sex in prison, usually not by choice, of course? You think those are absurdist comments, but I think what is the appeal, if I can get into the mind of this conservative base voter, is that they're not just hearing, they're not upset and that they're not hearing it from Obama or Hillary Clinton. They're not expecting to hear it from them. What they're upset about is they're not hearing it from John Kasich or Jeb Bush or previously Mitt Romney or John McCain. And so that's how that anger is being, I think, expressed right now, and that helps explain Carson and Trump and others who have no governing experience, by the way, however, and look where they are.
Well, and, you know, when we look at that, and before we move into the Democrats here, which I want to do, when you look at that Republican field, you know, we always gave this campaign the very beginning, as we gave the Democrats to Hillary Clinton, we gave this Republican field to Jeb Bush. But again, let me start with you, Tom, and go around the room very quickly. But that I don't think it's as simple as that anymore. Scott Walker, go ahead.
Well, maybe, you know, when I was last in the studio with you, you know, you asked me to sort of predict, and I think the state's bet, and I would still put my in-trade money or my mortgage payment on a Clinton-Bush race, ultimately, but I feel obviously stronger about the Clinton half of that equation, the Bush half, given the large field and all the different moving parts in the Republican primary, but so Bush is almost like a default pick there. But you're right, I mean, I think, again, to me, this Republican primary is really two primaries. And think of it as like two semifinal brackets or, you know, brackets in a tennis tournament or the NCAA tournament. And you've got the sort of mainstream wing of the party that's Bush and Kasich and Rubio and Christie. And I'm not sure where Scott Walker goes. He's the one guy I'm not sure which bracket he goes in. And then you have the Carson and Fiorina. Maybe Fiorina's in the establishment bracket. You have the Carson and the Trump bracket and the Cruz bracket. And whichever side of the party, the establishment, quote-unquote, Washington, you know, Beltway wing or the hinterland wing that's upset with Romney and McCain's nomination because they're too sellout, they're too centrist, they're too Washington, they're too mainstream. Whichever bracket consolidates first around its candidate is going to win this thing because the other bracket's going to continue fighting. And so Bush's challenge really is to consolidate the Christie, Kasich, you know, reflex voters into his wing before, say, Ted Cruz or somebody does the same on the other Trump-Carson side. And so to me, there's really two primaries within the primary.
Yeah, Len, do you think your party is wide open? Lenny?
In some regards it is, but I mean at the same exact time it's about money and it's about catching lightning in a bottle. Let's be honest, they wanted Mitt Romney to win that primary in 2012 a lot sooner than he did, and because he stumbled so much, you ended up having Michelle Bachmann, Herman Cain, Newt Gingrich. You went through five or six different names, Rick Perry before he stumbled, Tim Pawlenty before he lost to Bachman, and then eventually Rick Santorum, who had no money, who was at 1% until the Iowa caucuses, and then he started winning state primaries. So when you have that come into the mix, if you don't have the trip-up, you might not have the two-tiered system come into effect like it actually did in 2012. You may have more along the lines of what you had in 2008 where you have the establishment guy who it's, quote-unquote, his turn, just cruising along, letting people fall off and go from there. It'd be very interesting to see, though, because Ted Cruz, we haven't heard a lot from him lately. Rand Paul, we haven't heard a lot from him lately. Scott Walker is now that big, next big thing, a two-term governor that took on the unions and won. So if somebody can play the middle of being both the conservative hero, the Americans for Prosperity hero, and still be seen as establishment, Walker can do that. Kasich can do that. So Jeb Bush better do in, you know, to the point earlier, better do something sooner than later, because somebody like those two can win both sides of that quote-unquote bracket race before we get to December. If they win a couple of debates, start raising a lot of money, then they start taking over both aspects of the party.
Well, I'm going to take a quick break here. We're going to come right back, and I'm going to jump into the Democrats and into what happened to Governor Martin O'Malley and to Bernie Sanders, Senator Sanders, when they appeared together and were confronted by black and Latino activists, and what that says about this campaign, and also what the poll numbers are saying about Hillary Clinton in terms of who she's not attracting and why and what all that might mean or not mean. We'll be right back in quick break. Angel Baby by Rosie and the Originals. Rosie Hamlin of Rosie and the Originals, born on this day in 1945. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. That's Carole King. It's Too Late, which hit number one on this day in 1971. We're here with Nadia Purpus from, is it Purpus or Purpus? Let me just, I never asked you that.
No, it's Purpus. You Purpus. Got it right.
Yeah, I had to make sure I had it right. Nadia Purpus, who is progressive journalist, staff writer for Common Dreams, Lennon McAllister, Republican strategist, radio and TV host, Tom Schaller, political author and professor of political science at UMBC, and you at 410-319-8888. Please join us with your ideas and thoughts. We want to hear from you. So let's get to the Democrats here. I think there's some interesting stuff afoot, and maybe I'm making too much of this, but I've been writing back and forth with people at a number of journals around the country about this and what to talk about. One of the things, you know, of course, we all put Hillary Clinton at the beginning saying that she was the front runner and she was clearly going to win the primary. Bernie Sanders then began surging and really kind of hitting some stride. Martin O'Malley didn't seem to go anywhere, and Lincoln Chafee's also running, but I think that O'Malley's kind of waiting in the wings, waiting to leap as he did around the immigration issue. But both Bernie Sanders and Martin O'Malley were confronted by Black Lives Matter and Latino activists when they took the stage, and I think it was at Arizona. And when that happened, you know, I started looking and talking to people around, watching these dialogues happening, and Bernie Sanders with his rhetoric of economic populism has appealed to certain progressives and people on the left. And his self-identification as democratic socialist. But that appeal is not translated into the young activists from movements of color on the ground and the black and different Latino communities, and has not appealed to communities of color in general in this country. That economic populism just doesn't make the leap into all the issues around racial injustice and racial justice in America. So I wonder what you think this portends. And what this, you know, what this movement may mean in the course of these kind of changes may mean in this Democratic primary, and how it might even affect the general election. Nadia, let me start with you.
Sure. Well, I think that the event at Netroots Nation, in which the activists disrupted the O'Malley and Sanders speeches, was a sign that although their rhetoric may not be transferring to activists of color, they are paying attention. And basically, I think what that action represented was that they were telling these candidates that they have room to improve their stances, and that they have Bernie Sanders has said over and over that we don't need a candidate, we need a movement. And this is a movement. This is one of the Black Lives Matter movement is one of the most important actions, long-term actions that we've seen taking place in, at least in America, in God knows how long. And so it's very, very important for anyone who runs on progressive platform to take their concerns into account and to respond to their concerns. And so I think this doesn't portend anything bad per se. I think that it means that protest is becoming or has become a very legitimate form being visible and speaking out and gaining the attention of presidential candidates. And you'll notice after the disruption, Senator Sanders tweeted out some support for the movement. And so clearly it's working. The effort to turn the attention away from economic populism, and certainly that's important too, but it doesn't mean that it needs to take the place of speaking about racial justice and speaking about it as a separate issue, because it is also connected to economic justice, but it is also its own very separate issue. And it's important to bring that to the forefront of these debates, because it's an unignorable scourge, the widespread police brutality issues and the killing, the nonstop killing of Black Americans. So I think more, I don't think that it's an ominous sign. I think that it's a positive sign.
And so Tom Schaller, I think there's something that I've talked about over the years since 2007-08, which was the Obama effect, which brought lots of people of color and in numbers that were not seen before, and young people to vote. And again, the candidates we're seeing now are not catching fire with that population of folk in this country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think Hillary Clinton's advantage here is that she's the starter or default candidate for most of the African-American Democratic voters, whatever age, and most Latinos. I mean, her husband is the cliche, I know, first Black president.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
I think that there's still a connection between that family and the African-American community that goes way back. And then, let's remember that Hillary Clinton beat Obama by about a 2-to-1 ratio among Latino votes in that 2008 primary. She won the Latino vote in the primary. He won it in the general election, of course, over McCain. So for O'Malley or Sanders, they're going to have to, if that's where people of color, for the most part, are starting, then they have to move those voters or some subset of those voters away, and that's a tricky proposition. And I think Hillary Clinton, very early staking out a position as an economic populist, was designed to blunt or thwart or preempt the opportunity to do that. I think Nadia's right. I mean, and some of the messages about economic populism, they certainly resonate, as they should, in an African-American community where in some places after the economic crisis, unemployment's 25% and higher for men in some cases. So a message about minimum wage or something like that or basic health care coverage should resonate immediately. But when you have issues of policing and the penal system, I mean, the minimum wage is irrelevant to an African-American who's in federal prison. The minimum wage could be $10 or $15 or $150 an hour, and it's sort of irrelevant if you're not in the wage economy to begin with. So maybe Sanders or O'Malley need to differentiate themselves in some way from Hillary Clinton. It's going to be a little trickier for Martin because of what's happened in Baltimore in the past year, and then people starting to look into his policing policies and so forth. So I think it's going to just be very difficult for either of them. And of course, Bernie Sanders comes from one of the whitest states in the union. That's a hard sell there. Clinton's at least came from Arkansas. There's something there. So it's going to be a tough thing to do, but they're going to have to find creative ways if they're going to succeed in doing it.
But, Lenny, I mean, what I've been arguing with other progressive writers in the country right now about this back and forth by email is that we're at a point on the Democratic side of the equation, on the kind of progressive side of the equation in America, where a candidate is going to have to be able to marry the ideas of economic and racial justice in this country to be able to appeal to a broader base. That the difference between when this election and the last election was, because Barack Obama is Black, he didn't have to prove himself in that way. Just because he embodied something true or untrue, viscerally and someplace intellectually, that feeling among Americans. But something's missing here. And you've got three white guys running, and it's just not really pulling folks in. And you're watching now on the polls where Hillary is down even among Latino voters.
It's not, because she is still seen as the establishment. And people, just like on the Republican side, are sick of the establishment. Why is that? Because the establishment and many of the home areas of progressives and Democrats. They're run by Democrats. They've been run by Democrats for years, and it just so happens that that's where a lot of these individuals are dying. New York City is not run by Republicans. Leon Ford Jr. wasn't shot in Pittsburgh in a city run by Republicans. You can say that about Chicago. You can say that about Atlanta. You can say that about Los Angeles. You can say that about other cities around the country. So they're looking at this, and African-American voters, African-American millennial and Gen X voters in particular, are saying, okay, we have now taken over social media. We have now taken over things such as Twitter. We are using it to bring about awareness, and you're not responding to us. And it goes back to the point that was brought up previously. It doesn't really matter if you start talking about raising the minimum wage when black unemployment is twice as high as white unemployment. It doesn't matter if you're talking about raising the minimum wage if, I think they just had a report today from the Annie Casey Foundation, where one-third of all American households have children where neither parent has a full-time job. One-third, and that's across all races. We won't even get into African-American and Latino households. So if you can't talk about economic disparities from a racial perspective, considering what we're seeing with the schools, the economic conditions, and then the policing issues, and you start saying Black Lives Matter, which is, yes, a chant about police brutality, but it's also about how are we hired, where are we going to school, how are we valued as citizens. If those things are not taken in consideration when you have a Martin O'Malley or a Bernie Sanders on stage, if they're not really being articulated by Hillary Clinton other than by her saying, yes, Black Lives Matter, saying it and meaning it are two different things. And if you don't have that, I mean, let's be honest, it's taken Barack Obama all the way until basically 2014 after the midterms for him to start talking about some of these things. But by the time he would actually put a lot of these things in the place that he's talking about, he'll be out the door. So who's going to talk about implementation? You have the Republicans trying to engage minorities, but what are we talking about in regards to implementation? Same with the Democrats. If you have these presidential candidates that are not taking brave stances, or Republican candidates that are taking brave stances that also give a pathway to implementation, then it's just rhetoric. And people are fed up on both sides of the aisle with that, and you will continue to have things such as Black Lives Matter protests, die-ins in the streets, just as you'll have on the Republican side. You'll have the hard right wing pushing somebody like a Donald Trump up on their end of the polls as well.
So, I mean, yeah, let me just push about this a little further. I mean, I think that hearing what Lenny was saying, that there is, at this moment in America, especially in Latino communities, especially in communities that are based in immigrant populations, Mexican and Central American, and in black communities, a real rage going on about racism, about what's happening to people's families who are Latino in America, and whatever your position is on immigration policies. And I guess that rage is pushing so hard at this moment that when Barack Obama ran, Barack Obama was seen as a hope of that kind of change, and many people in Latino and black communities came out to vote for Barack Obama, as many progressives did, because they weren't going to allow a black president to be pushed out of the White House. There was an emotion involved in that. There's always an emotion involved in voting. It's not always about the head. It's about the heart and the soul. So the question I have is, if can the Democrats really push that feeling and rev that vote up to hit the heart? And I'm not so sure I've seen anything right now, Tom Schaller, that says that's happening.
No, and I think there would be a natural sort of abating of the black turnout rate, regardless of Hillary Clinton or whoever else was in the field and is the nominee, unless it was another possibly African-American on the top or even the bottom of the Democratic tickets. I just don't, that surge will abate a little bit no matter what, and maybe people will start to attribute it to some failure of the inevitably, obviously, white nominee for the Democratic Party, at least at the top of the ticket. So, but I wouldn't be surprised by that. And African-American turnout at comparable rates prior to Barack Obama. African-Americans turned out as a share of their population in the 2004 election, in the Bush re-election. So African-American turnout is actually not ever been a problem. And when you control for socioeconomic status, because they come from lower, on average, socioeconomic status, income, wealth, occupation, high school, college graduate, actually African-Americans outturn white Americans. You know, a black plumber with two kids and a wife who makes $40,000 is actually more likely to turn out than a white plumber with the same demographic profile. So I think African Americans will be there. They just are not going to be there at Obama levels. And an enthusiastic vote counts the same as an unenthusiastic vote. It counts one. So, but I do think, to get to the real meatier issues of what's going on in the country, you know, I do think it's good that we're starting to talk about these sort of things. I think it's a fair criticism that, you know, these cities are led by Democrats and often specifically black Democrats, and so it's an elite failure on their part. I heard this repeatedly in my response to my columns from critics, mostly conservative critics. But by that same logic, you know, most of the states are governed majority by whites, and certainly the Congress today, 20 years ago, 120, certainly 220 years ago, is it a white elite establishment. We've had 1,700 senators in American history, and 14 of them are black. So ask a conservative if they're happy with the performance of Congress, and they'll say no. And then ask them if that's a white elite failure. Nobody even asks that question. So, and not to sort of push back too much, but, you know, there's black elite failure in the country, fine. But there's also significant white elite failure in the country. And I think maybe that's some of the Trump phenomenon as well. I don't know. But Democrats have to sort this out because they have a more mixed race coalition, of course. Republicans really don't have this problem.
So, Nadia, before we have to take a break, let me turn to you. I mean, I do think, and when I look at what happened in places like Maryland, where the Democratic Party lost the governorship here from where we're broadcasting, not so much because the majority of just because the majority of voters voted for him is because there was a large segment of voters who didn't bother to go to the polls. Most was being black, Latino, and progressive voters, white progressive voters. And I guess that's what I'm wondering, what how that might play out in the national stage. Maybe it doesn't.
Mm-hmm. That is a good question. It's an interesting question, and it is a concern for the election next year. But I also think what's important to keep in mind is that a lot of voters may feel disenfranchised from their candidates because of situations where they feel like their concerns aren't being acknowledged and aren't being rightfully prioritized. And so I think that rather than looking at the statistics from this idea that the voters aren't turning out, it's important rather to look at the reasons that they're not doing so, and the ways in which those of us who are concerned with voting numbers and politicians who are running for office, how they can adjust to their outreach and their platforms to make those voters feel that they are being included and to actually include them. So, for example, there's this huge problem with voting rights being ignored and violated in sort of institutional ways.
Right.
And so that's something that we should focus more so on institutional roadblocks to voting rather than saying the voters aren't turning out, because it's not so. I don't think it's so much that they just aren't doing it. I think it's that there are many, many reasons why they are unable to participate in that process. And I also think that voting isn't the only way to express one's civic ideals.
Well, I do want to thank the three of you. This has been a great discussion. We'll have much more of this coming up in the course of the next year and a half as we watch this election unfold here and see exactly what happens. Nadia Prupas is with a staff writer with Common Dreams, Lennon McAllister, Republican strategist, host of Night Talk, and we'll get right with Lennon McAllister on News Radio 1020, and Tom Schaller, professor of political science at UMBC, writes a column for the Baltimore Sun, and his latest book, The Stronghold, How Republicans Captured Congress but Surrendered the White House. So, Tom, Lenny, Nadi, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mark, as always. God bless you all.
We're taking a very brief break. We're going to come right back. We're hearing Come Together by the Beatles, recorded on this day in 1969.